heart of the seacoast, from the hearts of book lovers, from the deepest depths of the library stacks. From the people behind the desk, we bring you Portsmouth Public Library's audio extravaganza, The Parrot Unbound, with interviews, panels, lectures, sketches, literature, reviews, and more. The library is honored to present The Parrot for your listening pleasure. Let us take you on a journey.
Welcome to Episode 6 of The Parrot Unbound, Portsmouth Public Library's podcast. You can hear us on SoundCloud and on WSEA Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Laura Horwood-Benton, Public Programming and Community Relations Librarian. You just heard our intro read by Tori Simpson-Tucker, a circulation assistant. Tori started here as a page in high school and came back to work at PPL after college, and we're thrilled to have her back. In this episode, Heather interviews writer Jeff Deck about his process, and I interview Geekosaurus cartoonist Kaylee Moulton about creativity. I also speak to Youth Services page Frances about her library adventures past and present, while Steve interviews retired diplomat and author John Eddy about his career in foreign policy. In between, you'll hear highlights from our March 2019 local history talk on the Isles of Shoals, as well as our recordings of contact with visitors from another galaxy. Finally, Steve talks to outgoing Youth Services Supervisor Susan Lawn about the evolution of the library. This is The Parrot Unbound from Portsmouth Public Library.
Hello, my name is Heather Armitage and I work in the Portsmouth Public Library's Technical Services Department and I'm a member of the Programming and Creative Content Committees. Today I am interviewing Jeff Deck, author, editor, ghostwriter, and public speaker. He is the author of several books, including The Great Typo Hunt, which was featured on the Today Show. Since 2011, the library has been a come-write-in space for National Novel Writing Month, where people are encouraged to try to write a 50,000-word novel in the month of November. Thankfully, Jeff has been involved since our first event. Kickoffs have included his clear instruction on how to sign up and navigate the site, advice for how to write through blocks, and some excellent writing exercises. His experience, generous spirit, and enthusiasm set the tone for a fun but challenging month. During our wrap-up gatherings, Jeff has also given excellent advice for what to do with that rough first draft. We are so thrilled that Jeff can share some of his advice, insights, and suggestions on this episode. Welcome, Jeff. Thank you for all you do for the Portsmouth Public Library, and thanks for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Heather, and thanks for having me on. And I should mention that Heather is a writer also, so keep an eye out for her name on a book cover sometime in the near future.
Thank you. Thanks. Let's see. Don't hold your breath, friends. So, Jeff, do you want to talk about the projects that you are currently working on?
Sure, yeah. So my big project right now is I'm working on an urban fantasy and mystery series that's called The Shadow Over Portsmouth. The first two books are out right now. The first book is called City of Ports, and the second book is called City of Games. I'm working on book three right now. I'm aiming to release it this summer, so hopefully if all goes well, it should be maybe June or July. I think maybe at least the first book is here at the library, so...
It is.
Yeah. That's my own big project that I'm working on right now, and as Heather mentioned, I'm also a fiction ghostwriter and editor, and so I help other authors tell their stories, and so I'm, you know, working with someone right now to ghostwrite a book for them and editing a couple other folks' books, so keeps me busy.
Can you talk about what that's like, ghostwriting, how you got involved in that? And
sure, yeah. I had had some jobs in various industries as an editor, and a few years ago kind of hung out my shingle as a freelancer for editing people's projects and helping them write them, and learned some information about ghostwriting, which is kind of the natural next step after editing. You know, for anyone who's done editing work, if you're doing a really intense editing / rewrite job on someone else's text, if you're writing enough new content in there, you're practically ghostwriting already. It's kind of an interesting niche that I found definitely has people who need its services.
Well, that sounds fascinating to hear. And also it must be difficult or an interesting challenge to like keep their voice while creating, or is that totally off base, like trying to keep their their content or their vision, but also
cleaning it up. Oh, yeah. No, that's totally on base, if you will. You have to leave your own ego at the door and make sure that you're in contact with the client and, you know, sending them stuff on a regular basis and having them give their feedback on it and, you know, saying, hey, is this in line with what your, you know, goal for this project is, what your vision was, you know, for the voice and the content you wanted in here? Because, you know, if they're the ones signing the checks, then, you know, they're the ones who call the shots. Mm. And it's kind of freeing in the way to, you know, in a way to leave those decisions to someone else and just be like, okay, boss, I'm going to do this.
And how about you? When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I had always enjoyed telling stories, you know, from an early age in kind of a visual format, kind of a, you know, like comic book style, like drawing my own panel by panel cartoons. And then in high school, I had a really good writing teacher named Mr. Sullivan, who kind of encouraged me and, you know, helped me realize that actually I kind of preferred telling stories in just like pure words, because I'd realized that the comics I was drawing, you know, would have these enormous, you know, dialogue balloons, and then, you know, they just kind of crowd out the drawing to just like a small portion of the box at the bottom. So with people like Mr. Sullivan's encouragement, I decided to focus more on kind of a novel-based method of storytelling, and I majored in creative writing in college and had a great thesis advisor there named Ernie Hebert, who's a well-known New Hampshire author in his own right. Mm. He kept encouraging me to try to take the monsters out of my stories. You know, he's not a big fan of that part, but I kept him in, so they're still in there.
And I imagine he finally came around for
yeah,
the monsters.
Yeah.
Do you have a writing routine or habit that you'd like to share with listeners?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it and thinking about the types of encouragement that I've been giving to other writers, especially lately, even like within the past couple of days. I feel like sometimes people who are writing, you know, maybe their first book or, you know, one of their first books, and they're scared of getting stuck. They're scared of like the, you know, this concept of writer's block. And so they want to have as thorough a plan as possible. And, you know, so they come up with like this, you know, incredibly intricate outline, and they spend a lot of time on like world building and lore for their world, you know, particularly if they're in fantasy or sci-fi, because, you know, in those cases the temptation is too great to just start looking at the past 100 years of history in your world. And then they never actually get to the writing, or, you know, they keep getting to the writing, kind of stopping, starting, and they end up going back to the outlining and think, well, if I get like a perfect plan for this book, then it's going to be easier to write. The reason why I really support things like NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, is NaNoWriMo's whole idea is just getting that first draft done and then having something to work with. And the realization and a lot of magic happens during the editing process. So you can't expect everything to be perfect the same time around. So your job should really be, you know, getting through that first draft, ideally quickly, so that you don't lose your momentum along the way. And if you find that it's kind of hard to sit down and write it, if it starts to feel overwhelming, then just break it down into smaller pieces, you know. And this is advice that can be transferred, of course, to a lot of other different fields, but it's definitely applicable here, where just start with like a 15-minute writing session and say, all right, I'm going to shoot to write maybe 500 words. And do that, you know, get up, take a break, do something else, and then maybe do another little session later on. It adds up over time. You know, no book gets written in a single sitting. You know, no chapter usually gets written in a single sitting, and, you know, unless you're really inspired. And people need to be able to break it down into its, you know, into very small parts, and it adds up over time.
That's great advice. I think that fits with a lot of things in life, where it's almost like creative procrastination, you know, where it's like, oh, if I can just make this outline perfect. So instead of striving for perfection, strive for getting it down on the page. That's really helpful.
Having something to work with, yeah. You know, and I find another hang up that people have too is to get this idea of, you know, do I have what it takes to be a writer? And they kind of look at it in terms of like inborn talent rather than, you know, skill that you work at over time and, you know, through practice and repetition and persistence. I feel like with most professions, it's not a question of whether you have it innately or not. It's just a question of, are you willing to just put in the time and not be afraid to fail and just keep at it until you feel more comfortable with it and not look at it as, you know, writers and non-writers in the world. People just, they get this idea too about, you know, athletes sometimes, you know, they see them out, you know, see a professional athlete out on the court and it looks like they're a natural and, you know, they might even be described as a natural and like, you know, in the sports articles about them or whatever. And, you know, you're not seeing all the time that they spent on the court or on the field practicing. In a similar way, when you go into like the bookstore or the library and you pick up, you know, this wonderful book from the bookshelf, you're only seeing the finished product and you're not seeing all the drafts of it.
While we were creating this episode of the podcast, our equipment somehow picked up communications between two presumed extraterrestrials. We were then able to meet these very special individuals. The FBI asked us to keep this audio recording quiet, but as librarians, we believe that information should be free.
Maximum priority. Repeat. Ahong.
Repeat, your ninth appendage was obstructing my airways.
Apologies. Are you injured?
I maintained equilibrium during our descent. My gases and organs are unharmed.
I regret using your ocular units to brace my tentacles for impact.
Flo, in what language are we conversing?
It appears the only equipment still functioning is the clerd.
Clerd?
The culture and language environment radius detector. It appears we are speaking
American English.
What are our coordinates?
Latitude 43.0721 degrees north. Longitude 70.7598 degrees west.
Clerd, we require galactic coordinates. Are we even still in sector 672.4888 DB system 7Q? What is this planet?
Planet Earth. Terra. Tierra, Arde, Jordan, Nchi, Bumi.
English only, cleared.
Earth.
System?
Solar System, Orion Spiral Arm, Milky Way Galaxy, Local Group, Virgo Supercluster, the Known Universe.
A very cold place.
Negative. I am overheated.
We must seek repair apparatus for the ship.
And collect data.
Primary objective is...
Explore!
This is Laura, and I am here with Kaylee Moulton. Thanks so much for coming in, Kaylee. Moulton is a local cartoonist, a writer, performer, magician, and a champion of nerds. I gave you that last time.
Oh, thank you. I like that.
She's the creator of a fantastic webcomic called Geekosaurus, in which she talks about the challenges and delights of motherhood as a nerd and, incidentally, as a dinosaur. All of her characters appear as lovable, upright reptiles of the extinct variety. She is a contributor on Geek Mom. She is also one of our infamous local troupe of Ghostbusters, and she makes balloon animals.
I do.
Okay, so one of the reasons I asked you here was for Geekosaurus specifically, mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what got you into the graphic arts and cartooning specifically.
Well, cartooning specifically is an easy question, so... Here at the library, everybody should go to their library and see what wonderful classes are available, because last summer, I believe it was, mm-hmm. Yeah, last summer, I got the newsletter in my email saying that there was going to be a cartooning class by the wonderful John Klossner, and I had just had a baby, and I needed to get out of the house, and I felt like I was just sucked into this vortex of I don't know who I am. And so I signed up for this class, not really knowing what to expect. I mean, I've been an artist for a while, but I read Calvin and Hobbes and, you know, stuff like that all the time when I was a kid. But I didn't really know what to get out of a cartooning class, but I thought it would be fun. So I came once a week for 6 weeks. And by the end of it, I had developed this dinosaur character that was just kind of going throughout her life. And as I was talking to John, we realized it has to be a thing. So I created Geekosaurus and figured, well, you know, it'll be something that I do on the side just for fun. You know, tell stories about my weird family and all the stuff that happens. And everything that happens in the comic pretty much is how it happens in real life. I mean, occasionally I'll take some liberties and tighten up the joke or whatever, but that's pretty much how our life happens. And I just made us into dinosaurs and put us in four panels and stuck it on the internet for everybody to see, because that's normal.
These days it kind of is.
I guess it is. I guess more people are
maybe
doing
not the dinosaur
that.
Bit.
But now it's been over a year that I've been creating this comic, and I don't see it stopping anytime soon. After, I don't know, about maybe 6 months in, I got picked up by Geek Mom to put the comic on their website, and now it's a regularly appearing column. Once a week, they get Geekosaurus.
So just to summarize, you were in a vortex of an identity crisis.
Yes.
After having a baby.
Yeah.
You saw the library newsletter. You came to a cartooning class at the library partly to get out of the house, but also because you knew you were interested in it. And now it's one source of livelihood and identity for you.
Exactly. No, that's exactly it.
What a great library story.
I know,
and
right?
And personal story. The other thing I think I'll say about the sort of online presence that you have is we're obviously very grateful here at the library for people like John Klossner, who is a nationally recognized cartoonist who has published in The New Yorker. I mean, he's like serious business.
Yes.
Being so generous with his time and energy at the library to enable us to offer a free class to the public. And it feels like in a certain way that you are continuing his legacy because you're so open about your cartooning process. And it might be like the emotional side of it, like, you know, doing a cartoon that reveals the difficulties of being a mother, but it's also all of the sort of behind the scenes and work in progress sort of posts that you share where you say, this is the actual structure of how I put together a comic. And I find that kind of stuff so cool and
well. I'm glad.
Useful.
I'm glad people find it interesting. I feel like it's important, especially when you're freelance, and I'm a freelance. I don't know. Insert a job, and I figure it out. But you know, as a millennial who has a lot of debt, like all the other millennials,
here.
We've had to find creative ways to make a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. And I found that as freelancers, we all have done the service a disservice by being so quiet about how we do the things that we do, how much we charge, what our process is, because there's plenty of space for all of us. It's not like we're, you know, oversaturated with cartoonists and balloon artists. And the thing about freelance is the thing that I do, even if you did the same exact thing, it would be a completely different style. I'm going to speak to certain clients. You're going to speak to certain clients.
Yeah.
If anything, we're hurting each other and hurting ourselves by being quiet about all those secretive little things, what our contracts look like and you know, how much do I charge for a project? Mm-hmm. And I think that by being more transparent, I'm not only helping newcomers into these businesses, but also helping existing people kind of figure out where they sit. Sometimes I come across other freelancers and I tell them, once I find out, you know, after a lot of prodding, how much do you charge for this service? And they'll tell me, and then I'll say, no, you need to charge more. You really do. You're not even in the middle of where everybody else is, and you could be so much better off not struggling as much if you put yourself and be taken more seriously, ironically. Mm-hmm. When you charge more, you get taken more seriously.
Absolutely.
These are services that people need that they really do need to pay for, and we just kind of brush it off as, oh, well, we just do this on the side, and so that means that we're not really professional or we're not really in this space. When, yeah, you are. You're the person in that space. Own
right.
that. You know, grab onto that
and
have that be a part of who you are.
So I think that sort of relates to one of the main subjects of your comic, which is motherhood, because I think that's another place where people's individual struggle often is invisible because, you know, you might be a stay-at-home mom or kind of on your own with it, and it's really important to have that community.
Yeah, it is. It's important to have a community, and it is hard to find. I mean, I know that there's parenting groups, mom groups, dad groups all over the place, mm-hmm. but everybody's different. Just like, you know, you have your friends and everybody else has their friends, and sometimes your parenting style doesn't mix with everybody else's parenting style, and you need to find your little niche kind of group. And so, like, I found myself going around to all these different groups trying to find if I can find one person, and I've kind of collected one person here and there from each group to build my tribe. If you don't do something like that, it gets pretty
isolated.
Pretty lonely. Yeah.
And so do you think that Geek Mom, the website that you create content for, that they have kind of cornered the market on one specific aspect of that? I mean, is there...
Each Geek Mom is really different. You know, everybody comes at each article from their own unique perspective, but also unified because we're all nerdy parents.
Yeah.
So Geek Mom and Geek Dad, also they're of the same thing. You know, it's just... nerdy parents talking about things that they find interesting. And I'm fortunate that they have asked me to be a part of that. And so that was pretty awesome, I have to admit.
Well, while we're talking about specifically having, let's say, student loan debt, and also finding things that you are able to work on while also performing the bulk of the childcare for your family, is this the life that you imagine for yourself as a child?
Oh gosh, no. You know, creativity is something that I've always had, but it's another societal construct. It's you know, you tell the creative kids that's a hobby, that's not a job. Mm-hmm. And, oh, you're so smart, you're so good at history, you're so good at English, you're so good at math, you're so good at science, you should go into da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I think a lot of creative people like myself, we internalize that, and that becomes, oh, well, you know, painting is fun, but obviously that's just a hobby. I can't have that as a job. That's not a real job. But there's plenty of creative, real jobs out there.
Absolutely.
It really wasn't until about 5 or 6 years ago, well, when I first reconnected with my now husband, that I really had that epiphany of, no, I can do this as a thing. And I think a part of that epiphany was because when I said, I really want to, you know, look into comic books and I really want to try to make a go as an artist. And he said, okay, let's do that. You know what? I know these people. Let me introduce you to these people. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Go talk to them. See if it's something that you like. And we'll, you know, if you like it, cool. And if you don't, whatever. I'll just go with you on whatever journey you want to go on. And that's really when I was like, oh, okay. Well, A, this is what a healthy relationship looks like.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And B, okay, I can do this if I have somebody who also sees what I'm doing and believes in what I'm doing. And from that point on, it was just like, how do I make this work? And all my jobs became my hobbies. The money-paying jobs became the side gig, and the creativity became the main thing. And I started calling myself an artist and a writer, and things that I hadn't felt were okay before.
On Tuesday, March 7th, 2019, Melissa Sagerer illuminated stories from the Isles of Shoals in one of our local history talks. Among other qualifications, Melissa, who has a background in anthropology and library science, has worked as a curator of Star Island's Vaughan Cottage Library, Museum, and Archives, and served as a White Island Lighthouse steward. Here's Melissa on the first Europeans on the Isles of Shoals.
Captain John Smith, of Pocahontas infamy, came to the Isles of Shoals in 1614. He really loved the islands and tried to name them after himself, the Smith's Isles. The name didn't really stick, as there were already fishermen calling it the Isles of Shoals, but he did make a nice map of New England, including the islands, and greatly increased excitement across England about this area of the world. By the mid-1600s, some 600 to 1,000 fishermen and their families were living on the Isles of Shoals, most of them on Hog, now Appledore, and Smedino's Island. They made their living cod fishing. They used to say you could walk on the water on the backs of fish. The sea was so thick with bounty there. The people who lived on the islands were famous for being very independent, lawless, and big drinkers. Many fishermen did not drink or fish on Sundays, though, the Lord's Day, due to a couple of convincing stories which turned into superstition. John Scribner Jeunes recalls that in 1643, three fishermen who were profane and scorners of religion began drinking on the Lord's Day. Their boat was cast away the next week, and they all drowned. In Religion at the Isles of Shoals, Lois Williams relates the story Reverend Brock, minister on the islands from 1650 to 1662. He was asked by fishermen if they could fish on Sunday instead of going to church, since they had missed some days of fishing due to weather. He let anyone fish, but promised to pray for large catches for those who stayed. 30 fishermen went fishing instead of going to church and couldn't catch more than 4 fish. The 5 who had stayed and attended church fished afterwards and took 500 fish. After that, the fishermen attended services whenever Reverend Brock had them. Lois explains that the story of Reverend Brock may have been exaggerated sermonizing by Reverend Cotton Mather, who relays this story in one of his sermons, but with superstitious sailors, the myth can be just as powerful as the truth. In 1679 to 1680, when Massachusetts tried to tax the people living on Hog Island, now Appledore, which was then a part of Massachusetts Bay Colony, 40 families took apart their houses, loaded them on boats, and rowed over to Star Island in New Hampshire, where they formed the town of Gosport to evade that tax. There was fear 100 years later, during the Revolutionary War, that the independent islanders might aid the British. So in 1778, New Hampshire ordered the people living in Gosport to the mainland. So they once again had to pack up their homes, literally their houses, load them onto boats, and float them 6 miles to shore, where many landed in Rye, New Hampshire. Some went to York, Maine, and some of the homes from the islands can still be seen there today. At least one house made it as far as Ipswich, Mass. After the war, some residents returned to the island, but the population never returned to its pre-war numbers.
Hong Kong! Observe this sign. It appears to be an alien life form examining a small plant with perfectly rectangular leaves.
Cleared. Analyze sign.
A universal symbol for a library.
What is library?
A library is a collection of information and resources made accessible to a community for reference or borrowing.
Aha!
Aha! We must travel there to research ship repair.
Cleared, initiate ship protection sequence.
That is not my primary function.
Hi, welcome to Portsmouth Public Library. Are you new to the area?
Affirmative. We are new to this planetary system.
Well, everyone is welcome here. I'm Christine. What are your names?
Flooring, Sorak, Knack for Knack, Hiss, Single Malt, Porklessing, Fast, Tinky, Tripocta, Fiskring, Fork. You may call me Flo, and this being is Ong.
It's so nice to meet you, Ong and Flo. I'd love to shake your hands, but it doesn't appear you have any.
I can shake all 16 tentacles.
And I have no appendages. My people float in greeting, and the rest of the time.
Christine! What can be found at this library?
We require parts for our vessel.
And cultural information.
Well, the library offers lots of books.
The uniform plant leaves.
Yes, pages. And if you're not a member of the library, you can still read them in the building. We also offer classes, museum passes, Wi-Fi, public computers with printing and scanning, copying, faxing, and lots of events like lectures, games, parties, workshops, concerts, films, and more.
Games!
Flo, we must...
What is games?
Oh, hi. I'm Andrew, and this is Chess.
Pleasure to make your acquaintance, Chess.
My name is Steve Butzel, and I'm the director of the Portsmouth Public Library. I'm joined in my office this morning by Mr. John Eddy, a retired United States Foreign Service officer who worked in the State Department for more than 3 decades. John is known by many within the Portsmouth Library community for having provided the spark that led to all of the world affairs programming the library has held over the past 4 years. Why don't we just dive in? My first question is, what motivated you to become and remain a Foreign Service officer for as long as you did? What made you tick and keep on ticking?
Well, I think the motivation is fairly general or even generic. I think the first motivation is there's a sense that you want to, although it may sound grandiose, you want to protect the United States and promote the welfare of its citizens. I think a second motivation is, to the extent possible, to use brains rather than force in solving the country's problems abroad. And perhaps the third motivation would be to the extent possible, while we're sworn to put this country's interests first, to try to bring about in some way, small way perhaps, the happiness, health, and welfare of the whole planet.
What would you say was your favorite country to serve in outside of the United States, and why?
Well, the easiest country, or most enjoyable country, I think, was Kenya. Our boys were small, and the whole country was just a big zoological lesson. There were plenty of animals around at that time, all of the big five, you know, the leopard, the elephant, the rhinoceros, and so on. And so that was wonderful, the jacarandas blooming there in the springs, beautiful country. But in terms of the career, the most interesting was hands down Saudi Arabia. Neither my wife nor I ever wanted to serve in an easy place. I never wanted a posting in Europe, for example. And in Saudi Arabia, we were 8 miles in the Persian Gulf, where we had a hot war going between Iran and Iraq. And we had all of the American citizens in our district. We had all of the oil. So this was easily the most interesting assignment.
You talked about the war and not being very far from it when you were in Saudi Arabia, including going really within miles of the war zone at times.
Yes, well, we would call in the consulate, surprisingly, not being military experts, were the ones that would call in the first ship attacks, you know, that we would hear about from various sources. And then 180 miles to the north, we had the bombing of our embassy in Kuwait. And there were always threatening noises that Saudi Arabia would be invaded by either Iraq or Iran. Hmm. Actually, we thought it would be Iran coming around the corner, but it turned out eventually to be Iraq.
You know, you describe, following up on this, living through some pretty unsafe situations. Can you tell us about an incident in which you felt perhaps the most in danger, and did the reality of danger as a part of your job ever cause you to consider other lines of work?
Well, the answer to the last part of it was no. I never thought I would make a good ski instructor, ballroom dancer, or anything of that kind. Foreign service officers in general don't think much about the danger. It's a risk that's accepted to serve the country. Many of these people, men and women, are quite idealistic from the beginning. In terms of me personally, I would probably cite, and it had its amusing side, 1969 in El Salvador, where the General Jose Alberto Medrano, who was the commander of the National Guard, which was the force in El Salvador, he was a rough customer. They would reduce the crime in the country by simply shooting petty thieves in a ditch. It's a violent country. It had the highest per capita homicide rate in the world. Anyway, we took part in an international fair in El Salvador about 1969, and General Medrano showed up drunk in our pavilion. And he was asking, he said he was in love, told me, he was in love with a Chinese secretary, as he put it, at the embassy, and he wanted me to produce her. He also wanted more whiskey. So I, on some pretext, I managed to get away and went to another room and called the ambassador. He said, well, the secretary's out to lunch. He said, you tell him that. And I said, should I give him whiskey or coffee? To my everlasting gratitude, because this ambassador, Bill Bowler, was rather strict in his personal life, he said, give him whiskey. So we did that. We went back and did it. But at one point, I heard someone say in Spanish, there's a son of a bleep here who doesn't go down well with me. And I looked up, and I saw that he had his .45 pistol pointed directly at my stomach. So I simply began to appear to be as nice a fellow as I possibly could. Eventually, the way we got him out of there is we had hired his niece. We thought we would use her in case we needed his help on something. She came in, and she eventually was able to talk him, and she let him out like a sodden lamb.
Oh, good. So that was over. Well, we're glad that worked out that way. Shifting gears a little bit, what would you say is a specific accomplishment or accomplishments when you served as a Foreign Service officer that you're most proud of and why?
Well, some of them were kind of piled up in terms of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
When I arrived, we had 50 Americans in prison in the Eastern Province, which is where all the oil was, all the Americans were, and which was my district. When I left, we had only two. Now, this sounds very self-serving, but actually, while our consular section, the young officers were awfully good, and I would often have preferred to be one of the prisoners than one of them. The heavy lifting was done with the Saudis, by the Saudis themselves. And they sent out a very religious man from Riyadh who confronted the director of the prison and who claimed there was no torture going on. And so the Saudis themselves, we had two capital cases, meaning these prisoners could have been executed. And I think, in general, we go far beyond what we're supposed to do within the limits of international law. But again, there are many hands involved in this, including, of course, the ambassador, who was very effective in Riyadh.
I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to know that of that role that someone like you needed to play in helping to represent the rights of prisoners, U.S. citizens who were held prisoners, and to go from 50 to free all but two, it sounds like, is remarkable. The issue of public relations in the work of the Foreign Service, the State Department, seemed to come up from time to time. And I wonder how central is the role of public relations to the work of an embassy in the State Department in general? And how do State Department officials walk that fine line of deciding what to share with the press and the public and what not to?
Well, we made those decisions well when, at the time when we still had the U.S. Information Service, which was virtually abolished in 1999, in my personal view, a great mistake. It was full of professionals who loved their work, who had had journalistic experience, who had had cultural experience in music or whatever it was, and they were very well equipped, as they put it, to tell America's story through the world, through publications. People abroad knew that we would put our best foot forward, but they never believed that we were peddling or purveying any incorrect or much less false information. So that was abolished in 1999, and these officers, Foreign Service information officers, were absorbed into the State Department, where I've said many times, I thought it was a huge mistake to have them seated next to political officers who have a completely different take on what their mission would be in the world.
Shifting gears a little bit to talking about some of the personal stories that you shared, your choice of career came with, I would imagine, some challenges for your family, for your wife and your children, but also made life incredibly special from my perspective. if I were to ask your children or your wife now about their thoughts on what it was like growing up or raising a family, moving all around the world, what do you think they might say?
I think that they would, to quite a significant extent, say they were glad that they did it. I fault myself when the boys were young in that I tended to think when we were leaving dogs behind because we couldn't ship them for quarantine reasons or their little friends would be lost, I tended to think I could solve everything by words, and I no longer think that that was true. I think some of the separations from their friends, changing the country that they were used to, their school, was fairly traumatic for them. I think I was a little too glib on all that.
Finally, and perhaps this is an unfair question or overly simplistic because life is rarely black and white, but I wonder, do you feel the U.S. State Department, over the course of your career, helped create more good in the world or helped cause more problems in the world? I know that that's sort of a provocative question, but what does your gut say?
Not provocative at all. I'm very glad you asked because this is the point at which I get to do my commercial.
Okay.
You know, there's an awful lot of misunderstanding of what the State Department does and what it has to do, what it has in order to do all these things. First of all, a lot of people don't understand that of the 15 cabinet departments, the State Department is number 11. It's one of the smallest. Total personnel strength of the State Department is 75,000 people, but 50,000 of those are not Americans. They're not U.S. direct hires. They're people for convenience whom we hire overseas. So we have only 8,000 generalists. These are the real diplomats. What they do, what they're involved in is, it seems almost endless. I mean, they're involved in food supply, they're involved in the environment, they're involved in arms control, they're involved in granting visas, they're involved in political analysis, they're involved in economic. So I think it's really extraordinary what they do, and I wanted to make that point.
You may know the name Thomas Leighton as the name of the ferry that takes passengers to the Isles of Shoals today from Portsmouth. I learned from Sandpiper, the biography of Celia Thaxter, written by her granddaughter Rosamund Thaxter, that Thomas Leighton first desired to be an islander in September of 1831. He was handed a flyer for an auction of the late Benjamin Haley's estate, including three of the islands of the Isles of Shoals. After discussing the possibility with his wife Eliza, he rode to Kittery to the auction to bid on them, but he was outbid. For years, he lamented that the islands had slipped through his fingers and dreamed about what he would have done with them. In April of 1839, almost 8 years after he first tried, he purchased those same three islands, Hog, Smutty Nose, and Malaga, jointly with his brother Joseph. Thomas Leighton also came to White Island to be the lighthouse keeper that same year, 1839, with his wife Eliza, his daughter Celia, who was 4 years old, and son Oscar, who was 3 months old. Son Cedric came soon after. Thomas Leighton would go on to build the Mid-Ocean House of Entertainment on Smutty Nose and the Appledore House on Hog Island, renaming Hog to Appledore Island, using the name of the earlier settlement there, for better advertising, because no one wants to vacation at the Hog House. Thomas Leighton's daughter Celia married her tutor Levi Thaxter, who was 11 years her senior. Levi introduced Celia to the literary scene in Boston. Celia Thaxter became quite famous for her own poetry, prose, her garden, her china painting, and the famous artistic people that she surrounded herself with and entertained on Appledore. C.T. Young, the writer, describes her. Celia Thaxter was, I sometimes think, the most beautiful woman I ever saw. not the most splendid, nor the most regular in feature, but the most graceful, the most easy, the most complete, with a suggestion of perfect physical adequacy and mental health in every look and motion. She abounded in life. It was like breathing a new life to look at her. Celia's family line is still connected to the Scholls. Here are five of her direct descendants on Appledore. Here they are in front of the foundation of Celia Baxter's cottage in the recreation of her garden.
Checkmate.
Does that mean I win?
Oh, no, Flo. I think you lost. But hey, have you ever read to a reading dog?
I cannot even read American English.
Well, if you're learning to read, sometimes it helps to have the comforting presence of an animal who doesn't judge you.
Yes, I have felt very comforted by you humans.
No, the reading dog. This is Desi. He's specially trained to listen while you practice reading.
One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. The dog likes it.
Hey, what's up, Andrew?
I'm just introducing these two.
Flooring scrag neck for neck is cis single malt purple thing fact take you try pop the fist green fork.
On and flow to the youth services section of the library.
We are learning to read English.
Oh, do you know about our language learning materials? You can check out books, audiobooks, and DVDs to learn English, or even use Mango Languages. They have an app.
Clerd!
Comlink opened.
Absorb this information.
American English, like, totally upgraded, bro. Get it.
You alien lifeforms have a lot to offer.
Aliens? I'm just about to set up for a lecture on aliens. Welcome to the local history series at the library. When Barney and Betty Hill first saw...
Zeta Reticulans!
The most dangerous being in this universe and every other!
This is Laura, and I'm here with Fran Dentino, who was a member of Brownie Troop 2148. This was the troop that spent the night in the library in the spring of 2007. That's about 12 years ago, when the library building had just opened. And Fran's here to answer a few questions about her memories of that time. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Great. So, Fran, I'm curious, when you were younger, what made the library part of your life?
When I was a little kid, my mom would bring me here and we would go to story time with Susan, and I've always just sort of spent my time here, and after school, when I was in middle school, I'd come here and just hang out. It's always been like just sort of there and part of my life, yeah.
And now I understand that you were actually a pre-Brownie in this troop, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
So your older sister, Maddie, was in the troop, and yes. What made you want to join?
A big part of it was Maddie being in it. She was just the coolest. She's still the coolest. And just having, like, a group of people to belong to and, like, have activities to do and, you know, learn, like, outdoor stuff has always been really fun for me. And that was the place to get safely knowledge to do that.
And why do you think that your Brownie troop chose to donate a cart to the library?
I think just because... the library is such an awesome part of our community, and Girl Scouts want to, sort of their MO is to help good parts of the community and, like, help educate people. So that's, I would say, probably the main reason, just trying to be a part of that and contribute to that.
Our supervisor of youth services, Susan Lawn, has been here for over 2 decades, and she will be leaving in 2 weeks. Do you have any memories of her or anything you can say from working with her?
Well, I used to go to story time with her, like, all the time when I was a little kid, doing all the voices, and she was just amazing with that. And having her as a boss has been amazing, and working with her. She's just so kind and so loves what she does, and you can tell that in every day when she works. So it's really been a pleasure to know her for so long.
What would you look for the person who is replacing Susan this month?
Those are some big shoes to fill. But just something like dedication and loving what they do and just loving being around kids and reading books and just overall just so kind and good-spirited.
Now, you mentioned that you are a page here at the library.
Yes.
What made you want to come and work for Portsmouth Public Library?
Well, I have awesome memories here, and it's just a place sort of where I fit in, and I love to read, and I love to watch movies, and that's just, this is like the perfect place to do that, so.
So, how old were you when you attended a sleepover in the library?
So it was 12 years ago, 2007, I would have been 6.
You were 6? Yeah. Do you remember anything from the sleepover?
I remember the skylights, like looking up at those and be like, what? Our library has skylights? Because I remember the old library and that definitely didn't have skylights. So that was like a big, like, whoa, like this is a really cool building. And just doing activities and kind of getting to like see it before it opened was really, really cool. Like just be there in the morning and be like, oh, like it's the library. Like it's not like our usual Girl Scout place. So it was just kind of fun.
And you got kind of behind-the-scenes look at the library.
Definitely.
So, do you think that when you go to school, you'll be leaving Portsmouth?
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to be going to Keene State.
What are you going to miss most about living in Portsmouth?
The community. It's just really a great group of people all around. And the fact that we are fortunate enough to have this, like, library and stuff like this is so amazing, and I'm thankful for it every day.
That's great. Thank you. And my last question is, what would you say to a 6-year-old who's in the library now? How can they make the best use of the library?
Just read everything. Read books about people who lived a long time ago and books about people that you don't understand. Try to get a knowledge of things that you can't find anywhere else. This is like the perfect place to go anywhere and do anything. So that would be my advice.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me. And thanks for working here. You're awesome.
Thank you.
Excuse me. You two, no running in the library or whatever it is you're doing.
Floating. In fear.
Protect yourself from the Zeta Reticulans!
Oh, in the lecture? But that happened almost 60 years ago. There's no need to be scared now.
Oh.
My people live 6,000 of your years.
Oh. Is there anything else I can help you with?
We require parts for our ship.
Yo, analysis complete, home slice. All systems repaired except navigations. Replacement orbital gear well required. Can you hurry up? I'm not trying to live on planet Earth.
We require a replacement orbital gear well for our ship.
Any chance you have the specifications? Maybe we could use our 3D printer to make one.
What is this?
That's one of our 3D printers, Ada. I have some device help time coming up. Do you want to come with me to study room 3 and we can look at your
orbital gear well?
It's finished!
Oh! Ooh.
From what material is this crafted?
This is PLA. It's fully compostable plastic derived from corn.
Corn?
An earth vegetable.
We require our own sustenance.
I think we have some pretzels left from the movie this week.
To the ship!
I am pretty sure Celia Thaxter had a bear. The only reason for me to doubt it is that I haven't seen a photograph or some concrete evidence that it existed, like a receipt for bear food in the Appledore Hotel ledgers. That, and because almost everyone I tell doesn't seem to believe it. But Celia Thaxter wrote a story about it, Oscar Layton wrote an account of it in his autobiography, and Fred McGill wrote the story down many years later. Celia's niece remembers it, but as a natural skeptic and a student of history, who knows full well that sometimes fiction can be handed down as truth and told and retold until everyone believes it, I had some doubt. So I'll walk you through my process in preparing for this talk in order to take care of the first obvious objection. A bear on an island or anywhere, that's just ridiculous. It may seem quite strange to us today, but Wikipedia tells me that a tame bear, often called a dancing bear, is a wild bear captured when the animal is young or born and bred in captivity and used to entertain people in streets or taverns. Dancing bears were commonplace throughout Europe and Asia from the Middle Ages to the 19th century and can still be found in the 21st century in some countries. I have seen a bear riding a bicycle and eating ice cream right here in New Hampshire at Clark's Trading Post. Has anyone been there? So it's not actually as far-fetched as it first seems. Here is the illustration that went with Celia's story when it was first published in St. Nicholas. This is more the size of the bear we're talking about. It was a tiny baby bear for most of the time it was there. We've probably all seen dogs bigger than this bear. The story starts to feel less ridiculous. Also, demanding photographic proof is a taller order than I first assumed. Today, we take pictures of every beautifully crafted salad, but back in the Leighton Thaxter household of old, not a single photograph exists of Thomas Leighton, patriarch and owner of several whole islands of the Isles of Shoals, builder and proprietor of the 500-room Appledore House and the Mid-Ocean House of Entertainment on Smutty Nose. Zero photos of him and only 24 surviving photos of Celia Thaxter, one of the most famous poets of her time. If we have 0 to 24 photos of two of the very most influential people in Isles of Shoals history, the fact that a bear was there for about 2 years and we can't find a photo seems a lot more reasonable, excusable, and perhaps expected. In the volume, Celia Thaxter's selected writings, in a preface to a group of stories, including The Bear at Appledore, Julia Older writes, "Most of the stories, according to Celia, hardly are stories at all, but real-life incidents that occurred at the Isles of Shoals. I do like to call this little bit of history Celia Thaxter's bear, but Fred McGill is the only one who actually names her as the owner, though it is always her family, more broadly, in other accounts, who owns the bear." So in Celia's telling, the bear comes as a baby from Georgia, is tethered to a stick in front of the hotel where children play, often roughly, poking sticks at him. In September, the bear broke free from his chain during a severe storm where he must have been badly frightened. She found him while walking on some cliffs when she heard something between a hiss and a whistle from a gorge below. She said, "A black heap curled up on a shelf of rock just below me, a few feet out of reach. He looked so comfortable, for it was the sunniest, coziest nook." She left him, and they didn't see him again for 7 months. Someone saw him clambering over a rock wall, and some men chased him. She says, "He plunged bravely over the rocks and suddenly disappeared, as a drop of water soaks into the ground in a large seam in the side of the hill. There they found his cave all strewn with bones and the feathers of fowls. They caught him and brought him back, where Celia led him about from place to place, even brought him into the house, though he was as large as a Newfoundland dog, and spread a mat for him in the corner. He disappeared a second time, and he was the terror of all the mothers who came to Appledore, and the children were guarded with the greatest care, though Celia says there wasn't any reason for so much alarm. He hid for another winter, and when he emerged for the second time, behold, he waxed huge and terrible to see." This is when they decided to bring the bear, by rowboat, to Lunging Island. Celia liked to collect wild pink morning glories on Lunging, and saw the bear grown bigger still. He was huge, heavy, horrid. They brought the bear back to Appledore in September, but he had a large appetite. He prowled about, seeking what he might devour. Bolts and bars were nothing to him. Such little impediments as windows he minded not in the least, but calmly lumbered through them, taking sash, glass, and all as he came. Then he made off with everything he could find in the way of provender, and kept himself hidden all day, safely out of the sight of men. Eventually, he broke into the biggest storeroom, where he made too much a mess, and spent the greater part of the night in that blissful lake of molasses. It was decided that this bear was too expensive to keep, and he had to be killed. As he was still on the loose, they kept watch for him. Someone was shingling a roof when they spotted him. They said he was steeping himself in sunshine after his night's orgy in the storeroom. Before he knew that danger was near, the sun had ceased to shine for that poor bear. This is a very blurry picture of Barbara Leighton Durant, who is Celia Thaxter's niece. who says she remembers the bear going missing and that she was often frightened when walking alone on Appledore. She was haunted by the story of the bear hiding nearby, and it would give her a thrill to walk where she could imagine the bear lurking.
Hi, this is Steve Butzel, Director of the Portsmouth Public Library, and this is a segment I'm calling Seven Questions with Susan Lawn, Supervisor of the Library's Youth Services Department, who will be retiring on May 1st. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Steve.
You started at the library in 1997. Yep. What have been some of your personal or department highlights, would you say, or what are a few that come to mind?
The biggest highlight of working in this library, in this department, has been that it is so absolutely, what would be the word, always evolving in a rapid but positive way. Always.
Always changing.
Never stopping. Yeah. Always changing. That, I think, is a big thing.
What have been some of the biggest changes?
Well, if you're talking about my career,
yeah.
I started this career before the internet.
Yeah.
We used to write accession numbers into the big old volume for every book that came into the library. It was all non-techie. And then we graduated to using a typewriter.
Wow.
And we were doing catalog cards for up until we went on to the computer techie stuff. And that was very exciting to me too, because to see that, to be a part of that transition to the technology from no technology, if you weren't in that period, you couldn't appreciate how wonderful it was. You know, this is going to save time.
Might you have any favorite patron interactions that you'd be willing to share?
Oh, I wish I could think of a particular one. It's just, for me, it's all about the children of all ages, and then, but adults can be children too, and that's fine. I just this morning, I just got all goosebumply because this little one was skipping into the library because this little one knew that this was her space, and she was going to come to story time. And you know, that is every day we see this interaction of the little ones with the library, not just specifically the people, but the library. So that's great.
I know that you and your staff have produced a lot of programs, from story hours to crafts to intergalactic adventures this summer, but
yeah.
Any particular library programs that you or your staff have produced or that were particularly fun, successful, silly, any of the above? Memorable?
Well, yeah, a couple of, one silly one, one really, really great one. This was when we were in the old building, so imagine having no property around. It's just a parking lot, basically.
Yeah.
Except for maybe a couple of feet of shrubs sticking, you know, between the parking lot and the building. Tracy Kane, before she became famous as the fairy house person, came to our library before she even wrote her first book. And she talked about fairy houses, and we all went out into that parking lot and found a little patch of dirt to build fairy houses. And I just never forgot how great that was. Yeah, it was really great. And the silly one was, we had a dog named Mikey, who its owner told us was the smartest dog in the world. And Mikey could do tricks, and we just have to have Mikey perform for the kids. So, of course, why not?
Sure.
She's a local dog who is very smart. We always think Mikey did not do one trick. He just stood there. He wouldn't do anything. And his owner just got mad, Mikey. And of course, we had 100 people there watching Mikey do nothing. So that was another
gotcha
moment.
Okay.
I guess he was that smart. he didn't want to do it. No one was going to make him.
You've talked a little bit about the influx of technology in the library and how it operates. Mm-hmm. How about its impact on sort of reading and reading-related technologies? How has that changed libraries or reading, or has it not?
I love this question. I would love to have more time to really think about it, but sure. Just off the cuff, I have been so amazed to see that the technology coming into the libraries, into the homes, has, if anything, impacted in a positive way reading print. I don't understand quite why kids seem to prefer print, the book, the physical book, and I'm surprised, but I'm also kind of secretly delighted to see that. I was a witness to the Harry Potter, you know, the big phenomenon of Harry Potter, and saw the effects of how J.K. Rowling changed kids who were reluctant to read into kids who wanted the biggest, fattest books in the library. Before that was Mark Brown with the Arthur books, the picture books. But she got kids reading fat fiction books. And that's never gone backward. It's just built on. So I'm just excited to think about how the kids love reading, and they need their library because they need that next book.
So my last question is, how are you planning to spend your first years of retirement?
Oh, sure. I have this thing in my head that I want to see every museum in the universe. That might take more than a few years, but I'll start locally. I just feel like that's a place I'd like to start exploring, the museums of all kinds. And there are so many wonderful ones, right?
Yeah.
You know, within a day trip.
Sure.
So that's going to be my new job for a while.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a fun job. And that concludes 7 questions with Susan Lawn. Thank you, Susan, for all you've contributed to the library and for this surprise interview.
My pleasure, and thank you.
You guys, I was waiting for like ever. Repair completed. Launch sequence initiated. Takeoff in 2 minutes.
Farewell, humans.
We depart.
We hope you've enjoyed learning about libraries.
There are other libraries? We must find them!
There are several nearby.
Float, no!
Cleared! Adjust course for the nearest library.
Ugh, fine. We will arrive at Rice Public Library in 1 minute.
Don't forget, if you decide to stay, you can get a library card.
And we have lots of resources for American citizenship.
And classes to help you find a new job.
Goodbye! Goodbye!
This has been the 6th episode of The Parrot Unbound from Portsmouth Public Library. Special thanks to Portsmouth Community Radio WSCA for putting us on air. Thanks also to Jeff Deck, John Eddy, Kaylee Moulton, and Melissa Sagerer. This episode was brought to you by Heather Armitage, Steve Butzel, Francis Dentino, Christine Fries, Grace Hanley, me, Laura Horwood-Benton, Andrew Holdsworth, Susan Lawn, Robin Nielsen, Michaela Pugh, and Tori Simpson-Tucker. An extra special thank you to Grace Hanley, our Community Relations Library page. Without her, this podcast would not have been possible. Grace is off to France this summer. Our theme music comes from Purple Planet Music, and that's a wrap for our first season of The Parrot Unbound. Until next season, happy reading.